भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। नारायणं नमस्कृत्य नरं चैव नरोत्तमं देवीं सरस्वतीं व्यासं ततो जयमुदीरयेत्। नष्टप्रायेषु अभद्रेषु नित्यं भागवतसेवया भगवति उत्तमश्लोके भक्तिर्भवति नैष्ठिकी। कृष्णे स्वधामोपगते धनमज्ञानादिभिः सह कलौ नष्टदृशाम् एष पुराणार्कोऽधुनोदितः। This is Granthraj Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 6. We're on Chapter 10. And we'll begin with texts 17 and 18, but there's not very many purports, so we'll probably go on and we may even finish the chapter because there's just not that much. This is, again, the battle between the demigods and Vritrasura. So you have on the board text 30. Vritro Suran Stan Anugan Manasvi. Oh, okay. All right. Okay, then I'll just read up until that point. Rudrairvasubhir Adityair Ashvibhyam Pitrivahnibhih Marudbhir Bhubhih Sadhyair Vishvadevair Manutpatim Drishtva Vajradharam Shakram Rochamanam Swayashriya Namarishyanna Surarajan Mrithe Vritrapurah Saraha. O king, when all the asuras came onto the battlefield, headed by Vritrasura, they saw King Indra carrying the thunderbolt and surrounded by the Rudras, Vasus, Adityas, Ashwini Kumars, Pitas, Vahnis, Maruts, Ribhus, Sadhyas, and Vishvadevas. Surrounded by his company, Indra shone so brightly that his effulgence was intolerable to the demons. Namuchi Shambaro Narva Divamurhar Shaposuraha Hayagriva Shankushira Viprachityrayon Mukhaha Puloma Vrishabharavacha Prahetir Hetirutkalaha Daiteya Danava Yaksha Rakshangsi Chasahasrashaha Sumali Mali Pramukhaha Kartaswara Paritsadaha Parishidhendra Senagram Mrityo Rapidurasadam Abhyardayanna Asambhrantaha Singhanadena Durmadaha Gadabhi Parighair Banaihi Prasamud Garatomaraihi. Many hundreds and thousands of demons, semi-demons, yakshas, rakshasas, man-eaters, and others, headed by Sumali and Mali, resisted the armies of King Indra, which even death personified cannot easily overcome. Among the demons were Namuchi, Shambhara, Anarva, Dvimurha, Rishapha, Asura, Hayagriva, Shankushira, Viprachitti, Ayomukha, Puloma, Rishaparva, Praheti, Heti, and Utkala. Roaring tumultuously and fearlessly like lions, these invincible demons, all dressed in golden ornaments, gave pain to the demigods with weapons like clubs, bludgeons, arrows, barbed darts, mallets, and lances.
Oh.
armed with lances, tridents, axes, swords, and other weapons like shatakhnis and pushundi. Though demons attacked from different directions and scattered all the chiefs of the demigod armies. Sarvata, they were coming from all sides. Now, we don't really recognize some of these names. We've heard them before, but who's Anarva? This is why the Bhagavatam repeats these things, because this verse will mean something if we understand just who these what they're called invincible demons are. We get a sense of the power that they were up against. So although Indra had this, he was armed with the weapon that they had formed from Dadichi, and he shone so brightly that his effulgence was tolerable. Plus, he was surrounded by all these wonderful demigods like the Vasus, Maruts, Adityas. What are the Maruts in charge of again? Anybody remember? Movement in general. Not only the wind, but all movement. So troop movement we hear about, right? This is all the province of the Maruts. They're in charge of this. So these are very powerful beings. Okay. Nonetheless, these demons attacked with all these wonderful weapons, just like shatakhni. Shatakhni means it can kill 100 men at one time. Right? Smart weapons, we might say, in modern parlance. And they attacked from all the different directions. Nate drishyanta shanchannaha sharajalai samantataha punkhanu punkha patitair jyotin shiva nabhokhanaihi. As the stars in the sky cannot be seen when covered by dense clouds, the demigods, being completely covered by networks of arrows falling upon them one after another, could not be seen. Nate shastrastrit varshaukha hyasheduhu surasainikan chinna siddhapathe devair lakuhastai sahasratha. The showers of various weapons and arrows released to kill the soldiers of the demigods did not reach them because the demigods, acting quickly, cut the weapons into thousands of pieces in the sky. Atakshinastra shastraukha girishringa drumopadehi abhyavarshan surabalam chitidustam shtapuravai. As their weapons and mantras decreased, the demons began showering mountain peaks, trees, and stones upon the demigod soldiers. But the demigods were so powerful and expert that they nullified all these weapons by breaking them to pieces in the sky as before. We find throughout the Bhagavatam when there are big fights like this, isn't it? Where else have we seen this? That when the weapons ran out, or when they didn't have so much strength, they started throwing stones and mountains and trees? Anybody? Huh? Yeah, many places, actually. Dvivara Gorilla, I was thinking, they were throwing trees at one another. So, tan akshatan swasti mato nishamya shastrastra pugair atavratranathaha drumair drishadbhir vividad prishringair avikshatam statra surindra sainikan. When the soldiers of the demons, commanded by Vritrasura, saw that the soldiers of King Indra were quite well, having not been injured at all by their volleys of weapons, not even by the trees, stones, and mountain peaks, the demons were very much afraid. Sarve prayasa abhavan vimokhaha kritakrita devaganeshu daityaihi krishnanukuleshu yathamahatso kshudrai prayukta ushati rukshavachah. When insignificant persons use rough words to cast false angry accusations against saintly persons, their fruitless words do not disturb the great personalities. Similarly, all the efforts of the demons against the demigods, who were favorably situated under the protection of Krishna, were futile. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. There is a Bengali saying that if a vulture curses a cow to die, the curse will not be effective. Similarly, accusations made by demoniac persons against devotees of Krishna cannot have any effect. The demigods are devotees of Lord Krishna, and therefore the curses of the demons were futile. All you have to do is Google Hare Krishna or ISKCON, and you'll come across some of this, some examples of this, basically impotent people criticizing or using rough words against saintly persons. I remember when I was in college, I used to look up ISKCON, and I was thinking, when I first discovered what kinds of things you'll find about Hare Krishna on the internet, I was thinking that if the internet was our only means of preaching Krishna consciousness, no one would ever join. However, if a vulture curses a cow to die, the curse will not be effective. Many places throughout the Bhagavatam it's said like this. Sometimes we feel, you can see there's some oscillation going back and forth here. Sometimes the demigods are very chuffed, and Indra comes riding out in all of his splendor, looking more effulgent than the sun, because he's got this Dadichi weapon. And at the next moment, there is volleys of arrows and bludgeons and Tomara weapons and Shakti weapons all raining down upon them from all sides, so much so that one on the outside couldn't even see them anymore. They were totally covered by these weapons. And then, so the demigods might be a little nervous about that. But now we see that the demons, having run out of steam, so to speak, they resorted to throwing natural weapons like sticks and stones. You see sometimes marginalized societies, when they rise up against their exploiters, sometimes they result to things like this. Every once in a while you hear, for example, in Palestine or someplace like that, they will throw stones and others at tanks. What are you going to do? Anyway, so the demigods are devotees of Krishna. Even if they're not pure devotees, they are protected sometimes, if he wants. And they were favorably situated at the moment. Therefore, they could not be hurt. Now we have te swaprayasam vidatim nirikshya harau abhakta hata yuddha darpaha palayanaya jimukhe visrijya patimmanaste dathuratta saraha. The asuras, who are never devotees of Lord Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, lost their pride in fighting when they found all their endeavors futile. Leaving aside their leader, even in the very beginning of the fight, they decided to flee because all their prowess had been taken away by the enemy. What happened here? What happened with the demons when they saw that none of their weapons were even phasing the demigods? What did they do? They turned and ran, even though it was in the very beginning of the battle. Now, these are not ordinary soldiers, so we've mentioned some names that don't mean much to us, but they're not the kind of persons. They're not weak-minded persons who would normally run from battle, but this was the intensity of the futility of their effort. They realized that there was really nothing that they could do. So let's see what happens next. We have on the board, Vritro Suram Stan Unugan Manasvi. Oh, I'm sorry. All right, well, I'm just going to go on then. The book was marked at 30. Okay, vritro suran stan anugan manasvi pradhavata prekshila babhasha etat palayatam prekshya balam cha bhagnam bhayena tivrena vihasya viraha. Seeing his army broken and all the asuras, even those known as great heroes, fleeing the battlefield out of intense fear, Vritrasura, who was truly a great-minded hero, smiled and spoke the following words. Manasvi, the word is used, means a strong-minded person, or a noble person even. And payena tivra paya, the word is also used, intense fear. So he said, kalopapannam ruchiram van manasvinam jagadavacham purusha praviraha heve prachitte namuche puloman mayanavan chambarameshrunadvam. According to his position and the time and circumstances, Vritrasura, the hero among heroes, spoke words that were much to be appreciated by thoughtful men. He called to the heroes of the demons, O Viprachitti, O Namuchi, O Puloma, O Maya, Anarva, and Shambhara, please hear me and do not flee. The word here is used also, Kala Upapannam. He spoke suitably according to time, place, and circumstance. That's an art. And therefore his words were appreciated by others who were also manasvi, thoughtful. Same word again is used. So, jata simrityur dhruva eva sarvataha pratikriya yasyana cheha karta loko yashas chatha tato yadi hi amum ko nam amrityum navranita yuktam. Vritrasura said, all living entities who have taken birth in this material world must die. Surely, no one in this world has found any means to be saved from death. Even Providence has not provided a means to escape it. Under the circumstances, death being inevitable, if one can gain promotion to the higher planetary systems and be always celebrated here by dying a suitable death, what man will not accept such a glorious death? Purport by Srila Prabhupada. If by dying one can be elevated to the higher planetary systems and be ever famous after his death, who is so foolish that he will refuse such a glorious death? Now, this is a rhetorical question, which Srila Prabhupada doesn't answer in his purport, but the answer is implicit in the text that we've just read. Someone who is intensely fearful, and a demon by nature must become fearful, at least sometimes, even if that person is himself manasvi, very strong-minded and otherwise heroic, because simply by dint of being a demon, harau abhakta sekutoma hadguna, Srimad Bhagavatam says, the demons cannot possibly have good qualities even if they temporarily manifest something that is, what we can say, homological, that looks like a good quality. So the demons are subject to fear. What do we hear from Bhagavatam about the origin of fear? Yeah. Bhayam dutiya bhinaveshita syat. As soon as you perceive something second, something non-Krishna, something other than Krishna, and as soon as you turn away from Krishna, ishad apeta, that's the next word, then fear must be your constant companion from that point on. And it's just a question of the variables as to how intense that fear becomes. So the demons are necessarily afraid. They have to be. It's just a question of producing sufficient tests to induce that fear. Now, for a devotee, it's also the same thing, and that's something that we need to consider. Maybe before we consider that we're very advanced in Krishna consciousness, or that whatever we perceive to be ourself at the present moment is in fact our eternal constitutional position, maybe we should consider that we simply haven't been given a test that's challenging enough. Otherwise, we would turn and flee in fear from Krishna consciousness, just like these demons have. When I was in college, of course, it's not entirely comparable. I was translating a Buddhist sutra, and the concluding verse of that sutra said that if someone actually understands the knowledge that's being presented here, then that person will immediately lose control of his bowels. We could restate this in modern parlance, but I'm sure you can all imagine how to do so. So I won't do that now. Anyway, so this is the idea, that tivra bhaya, there was out of intense fear that we cannot imagine, because we don't even know what's at stake here, not understanding the names and the factors that are involved here. But that's the answer to Srila Prabhupada's question: who is so foolish that he can refuse a death that will provide glory in this world and elevation in the next life? Well, the answer is pretty clear. Someone who is convinced that he is the body, or wants to be. That's the person who will refuse such a glorious death. And these are some of the reasons that we're being presented with this example by the armies of Vritrasura. Now, there's another thing to consider. When everything is good and you possess a lot of karma or a lot of gyan that is of interest to other people in this world, that long they will be favorable to you. What's a good example? Probably the most prominent example, at least in modern society. If you have a lot of money, you've got a lot of friends. You've got a lot of people, hangers-on and sycophants, who want to praise you at any moment, because they actually don't have any respect or affection for you. What they like is your money. A lot of people approach Krishna in that way. How does he feel? So, Vritrasura has now realized this, and there are other examples throughout the Bhagavatam of the so-called relatives, friends, allies, swajana, it's called in Sanskrit, your own men. They will abandon you in the snap of a finger if it serves their interest, or if you are no longer potent to serve their interest. They will abandon you in a moment. That is love in the material world. Antarajale graha grihita pado visrishta viklishta samasta bandhuhu tadaga jendro nitaram jagada govinda damodara madhaveti. When Gajendra found himself abandoned by all of his friends and relatives because he had been grabbed at the foot by a crocodile who would not let go. That's what crocodiles do. They clamp down, they lock on, and they thrash vigorously until you're dead. So all of his so-called friends and relatives and everybody fled. They all abandoned him. And this was Vritrasura's condition. Now, Gajendra, being pious devotee from his previous life, he decided to chant Hare Krishna at that time. And he took shelter of Lord Narayana. Narayana Akhila Guru Bhagavan Namaste. This was his prayer. Srila Prabhupada comments there, I think it's 8th canto, chapter 3, text 1 and 2, perhaps. He says that Gajendra's position in his previous life was whom? King Indradyumna. And King Indradyumna, somehow or other, he inadvertently offended Agastya Muni. He was the king of Tamil Nadu. Of course, Tamil Nadu is a new state in South India, but it's culturally, that kingdom has been around for a long time. And he was the king there. And Agastya Muni also is known as having settled in South India. Once I went to one of these Agastya readers, Nadi readers, and just from considering the first initial of my name and looking at my thumbprint, he knew very many significant details about my current life. And he also said he knew significant details about previous lives, but there would be even more detailed information if he found a manuscript that had all this information written down. It said that Parvati, once Agastya Muni went to Parvati and asked her about all of her children, and she said, "My children are all the beings in the universe. What would you like to know about them?" He said, "I want to know everything." So she gave it to him. And all that information has been written down, and they keep it in the, I think it's maybe Sarfoji Maharaj's library somewhere in Tanjore or something like that, they say. And so if you go there and they find a manuscript that matches your print, then they can tell you all sorts of things. In the north, they also have similar thing, Bhrigu readers. Anyway, this was Agastya Muni. So he was offended by Maharaj Indrajumna somehow, and he was cursed to become a crocodile or an elephant, an animal. But even an animal, if he has a sense of dharma, he can come to Krishna consciousness. We were discussing this before. Humanity is not biologically defined. Dharma sahina pashupisamana. If you don't have dharma, then even if you're biologically human, you're not human. This is the judgment of the Srimad Bhagavatam, and all Vedic literatures for that matter. Therefore, Srila Prabhupada used to quote from Hitopadesh, which is more or less a secular Smriti literature. Ahara nidra bhaya maithunam cha. If we are concerned only with eating, sleeping, mating, and defending, then we're no better than animals. So Gajendra, even though he was an animal, and a dull animal at that, slow, elephant, but because he had a sense of Krishna consciousness that he retained from his previous life as Indrajumna, he was able to take shelter of the Lord even in that body. And Prabhupada writes there that because in his previous life he was chanting a particular mantra, a particular stotra, he was able to remember this, even as Gajendra. That samskar he retained into his next life. This is the benefit of those of us who are chanting stotras and who are chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, every single day, so many times a day. It has to stay with the subtle body. The stamp is put on the mind. Samskara in Hindi and Bengali, modern Indo-Aryan languages. When you come out with a new published edition, that's called samskarana. It's a stamp, imprint. So samskara means the imprint that's placed on your psychology. And you carry it with you in the subtle body to your next gross body, even if that happens to be an elephant. So because he had this sense of dharma and some recollection from his previous life, Gajendra was able to call out the name of Lord Narayana when he was in such danger. Unfortunately, we're looking at asuras right here, and they're not inclined to do that because they are very much dedicated to their hopeless ideal of remaining independent of Krishna forever by any means. What's the problem with the asuras? Why do they have fear? Because they've turned away from Krishna. Why do they have the false ego that impels them to do anything and everything to gain their ends? Because they want to be separate from Krishna. The ego is simply an agentive cause. In Sanskrit, we have different causes. There are instrumental causes and there are ultimate causes. So the instrumental cause is that we have this incarceration in a mind-body complex that is constantly mutating and influenced by the external environment. But the ultimate cause of our suffering is that we have turned away from Krishna. We have chosen to embrace a false ego, even though it's constantly morphing. And as a result of that perpetual choice, which we make at every moment in one way or another, our sufferings will go on. This is what it means to be a demon. Therefore, they have eventually, as they must, by the vicissitudes of karma, they have come to find themselves in intense fear, so much so that although they're known as great heroes, even amongst the gods, they're feared, but they ran, even at the beginning of the battle, in intense fear. So, let's continue with Prabhupada's purport. Similar advice as what Vritrasura is here chastising them indirectly, and Prabhupada notes, similar advice was also given by Krishna to Arjuna. My dear Arjuna, the Lord said, do not desist from fighting. If you gain victory in the fight, you will enjoy a kingdom, and even if you die, you will be elevated to the heavenly planets. Anybody know that verse? Where does it say that? It's in chapter 1, text number 9. Anyecha, what is it? No. It's in chapter 2, text number 37. Hato va prapsyasi svargam jitva va bhokshyasi mahim tasmad uttishta kaunteya yuddhaya kratanishtaya. O son of Kunti, either you will be killed on the battle and attain the heavenly planets, or you will conquer and enjoy the earthly kingdom. Therefore, get up with determination and fight. Purport. Even though there was no certainty of victory for Arjuna's side, because after all they were outnumbered by what? About 75%, as I recall. They were hopelessly outnumbered. He still had to fight, for even being killed there, he could be elevated to the heavenly planets. We know what Krishna says next, do we? After that, sukha dukhe same kritva labha labha jaya jayo tato yuddhaya yujyasva naivam papam avapsyasi. He says, fight for the sake of fighting. Don't consider your happiness or your distress, what you'll gain or what you'll lose from it. If you do like this, Krishna says, then you'll not be touched by any kind of sinful reaction. And we've seen that there are demons who have this attitude. When in the beginning, who was speaking this? Sanjaya. Sanjaya was observing that there are many, or Duryodhana, there are many other heroes and who are prepared to lay down their lives for my sake. Mad arthe tyakta jivitaha. They're on the wrong side. Duryodhana is describing, there are so many men, they're willing to die for me. There are people in this world. To attain their mundane ends, they're prepared to die. And so many men have given their lives for a great cause, so-called great cause. So when we have that kind of determination, and when we face the kinds of weapons that these demigods are facing, and don't flinch, then Krishna consciousness will spread very nicely all over the world, because we've absorbed it ourselves. So Prabhupada continues, everyone should be ready to die while performing glorious deeds. That one sentence is a purport in itself, isn't it? A glorious person is not meant to meet death like cats and dogs. Now, this is Vritrasura talking to his armies, the demons who are supposedly going to fight with him against the demigods. And he's chiding them that you're not really acting in a very noble way. In chapter 18 of the Bhagavad Gita, we also learn what are the qualifications of the kshatriya. Shauryam tejo dhritir dakshyam yudhe chapi apalayanam. Dhanam ishvara bhavascha kshatram karma svabhavajam. The natural activities or functions of the kshatriyas that are born of their nature are that they have these qualities. Shaurya. What does shaurya mean? He's shauri. He's a hero. And teja. They actually have some potency to be heroic. There's no sense in being heroic if you're a vulture criticizing a cow. Right? They actually have some teja. They've got some power, some potency. And dhriti, they have determination. They don't flinch when the going gets tough. Dakshyam, they're resourceful, they're expert. Yudhecha api apalayanam, and they don't flee from the battle. What we're seeing here in the armies of Ritrasura is the exact counter of this. Dhanam, they are very charitable. Ishvara bhava, and they have the sense of being the Lord or the controller. But in a good way. Their sense of lordliness is not used to exploit others, which is usually what we see. right? Half of the Middle East now is up in an uproar because of exploitive governments. And it's not like any other government is less exploitative. It's just that they're a little bit more sophisticated, or, you know, they cover their tracks a little bit better. But Ishwarabhava, the Kshatriya has Ishwarabhava, but his ability and his sense of controlling others, it's used for their benefit. That's a very rare combination. To find someone who's competent and pure at the same time is very rare. You can find many competent people, but they're not thinking of your welfare. And you can find many pure people, but they're not necessarily very competent. But to find someone who's both, that's very rare. Srila Prabhupada was like that also. And there are some others. So anyway, this is Vritrasura's condition, and there's only one more verse in the chapter. It doesn't have a purport, so I'm going to finish it. Dvau samatau ihimrit yudurapau yad brahma sandharana yajitashuhu kalevaram yogarato vijahyat yad agranir virashaye nivrittaha. There are two ways to meet a glorious death. He's instructing his armies who have their backs to him at the moment. There are two ways to meet a glorious death, and both are very rare. One is to die after performing mystic yoga, especially bhakti yoga, by which one can control the mind and living force and die absorbed in thought of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The second is to die on the battlefield, leading the army and never showing one's back. These two kinds of death are recommended in the Shastra as glorious. Thus ends the Bhaktivedanta purports of the 6th canto, 10th chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled The Battle Between the Demigods and Vritrasura. Just one final note here. We are addressing two natures in this verse, Vritrasura. One is the Brahmin, or the devotee, and the other one is the Kshatriya, or the leader of whatever sort. And he's emphasizing that when death is upon us, there's a couple of things we have to do. We have to be able to control the mind, and we also have to be able to control the living force. What's the difference between those two? Well, let's say this. One should control one's mind, and one should keep one's body and soul together, as Prabhupada said. That's very difficult to do. I just saw my mother die a week or so ago. It's really not easy to do. She looked straight at me. She was alive. She didn't see me. Because the synapses all start to misfire when the mind-body complex is starting to disintegrate as we approach death. The mind no longer works. The senses no longer work, and the brain doesn't connect with them. And you don't have the ability to keep body and soul together even. And we're being instructed here that at the time of death, we have to do that. That's why we have such intense sadhana. We get up early in the morning to practice, because it's understood that unless you do this, it's not very likely that it's going to be burnt into your chip, so to speak, by the time you're ready to die. We hear a very appreciable point that we often hear from His Grace Amala Bhakta Prabhu. He kind of implied the other day in his class as well, that as we approach death, we're thinking of the pains of old age, that we get arthritis and it's hard to walk, and we're at risk for falling and breaking our hip and whatever. But we don't often consider the psychological impact of impending death. It's a whole universe into itself, and it's very much neglected. But when the independence in particular is removed, when everything that we're proud of, our strength, our intelligence, our independence, right, our whatever power or potency we have temporarily, only by dint of our karma, when that starts to be removed, then the mind freaks out, because we've identified with this for how many years? Decades. Life looks very different from the vantage point of death. It looks very different. All the priorities change. And these poor people, when they die, they become so confused and they become so disheartened that they don't have any alternative. They simply want to die. My mother was asking the doctor, please give me a pill, just put me out. Because the body becomes so miserable that you can't stand to stay in it any longer. That's why we die. Are we ready to handle that? Not if we can't stand our neighbor. Not if it's too difficult to take a cold shower. These are the things. So we practice. Therefore, it's called sadhana bhakti. And success in this endeavor, it comes through the mercy of the great souls. Anyway, we'll stop there. Anybody have any questions or comments? Archita Prabhu? Yeah, just we'll... Okay, two technical questions. One is...
One is that in our own lives, we summarize things. Like, you know, I have a lot of friends who were in the war, let's say. And when they're telling you what happened there, they're summarizing. You know, my buddy said this and the general said that. And so is that what's happening here? When Shukadeva Goswami is telling Parikshit about this battle between the demigods and demons, is he literally reciting exactly what Vritrasura said, or is he summarizing? That's one question. And then the other one had to do with your nadi experience. It would seem there's a little disconnect there, because if Agastya Muni asked Parvati many eons ago, and she gave him the details of all the souls, obviously since then a lot has happened, so how can they be accurate unless they're downloading updates every day? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, for the second question, I don't really have an answer ready. It's not my field, and nor is it a great concern for me, but it's just... I did experience that I had my mind blown, and they don't charge you anything either. Unless they find your manuscript, they don't even charge you. You know, he gave me quite an afternoon of entertainment, or infotainment, I should say. And it was free, because unless they find your manuscript, they don't charge you. And even then, it's pretty cheap. But that's just an interesting point of sight. As far as your first question as to whether this is these are literally the exact words of Vritrasura, or if they're being paraphrased and perhaps summarized, expanded, or whatever... it's kind of hard to say, because throughout his books, Srila Prabhupada kind of implies that these are the direct words of, you know, whoever is speaking them. And we have to take it that way, because we don't really have much alternative. On the other hand, it's been my observation from reading various scriptures that they are often restated in other ways. In fact, the very word we have for translation, anuvad, simply means retelling. And particularly with Ramayana, it's very well known amongst scholars that there are many Ramayanas. It's Valmiki, of course, is the first and most authoritative, but it's been retold in many, many ways, both in Sanskrit and in the vernacular. And, you know, it's up to whoever if you want to accept that as authoritative. But as far as we're concerned, we accept the Srimad Bhagavatam as the Pramanam Amalam. It's absolutely spotless. And it would seem as if Srila Prabhupada not only took these things literally, but also took them as absolute truth. So, I mean, that's one thing I can say there. Yeah, Shanshi Tanoi Puru.
I don't know how to put this question, but you were mentioning that the demons, were running away.
It was mentioned that they're fearful. So I was just thinking that also you were mentioning that the psychological is another whole aspect of the, how do you say, at the time of death, how one thinks of many things. So I was just thinking, is there any record ever done about those people who actually don't, they're completely atheistic or demoniac, but out of fear, maybe they change their view towards the theistic view?
That's a very good question. Before we address that, your question is, are there people who out of fear become godly? I think. Is that, have I understood? Yeah, there's the saying, there are no atheists in foxholes. That has some validity. I'd just like to mention that my mother, about 5 years ago, she had a massive heart attack that left her invalid and nearly killed her. She was in a coma. She had to learn how to walk all over again. She couldn't speak. She didn't recognize anybody, et cetera, et cetera. Now, at that time, the doctors told us that she has hours, perhaps days only, to live. You have to make a decision. We can keep her alive artificially, or we can pull the plug, so to speak, as they say. And so we tried to present this, as soon as my mother became a little bit more communicative, we tried to present this question to her, do you want to live like this or do you want to die? My mother, up until this time, had always had a, what they call a DNR status, do not resuscitate order for the doctors. That's the advanced healthcare directive. And she always made it clear to us that I don't want to stay alive if I have to stay connected to tubes and everything. But when the moment actually came for someone to pull away the oxygen that was keeping her alive, we asked her, do you want us to do this or not? She said, no. I gotta breathe. You see? So that's the intensity of the situation. When you're actually facing death, you will turn and flee like these demons did. We do it every day on a small scale. What to speak of with such a tivrabhaya, as we mentioned. So, back to the question about whether people actually can turn, whether fear can affect a change in heart, perhaps is another way to restate it, that. I think, again, that you have to really look at the most fundamental aspect of our psychophysical incarceration, which is the fact that we really want to be independent of Krishna. We want to take his position, and we want to be free from his... Either we want to exploit his energies, or we want to escape his influence. These are the two things represented by karma and jnana, respectively, in the material world. So it's, as I said, Maya serves this instrumental purpose of humoring that impossible desire. And it doesn't seem to me as if fear alone can really root that out, although it may help in some ways. That's just my personal view on it, and it's not even necessarily a final conclusion. I don't know if somebody else maybe has an answer for that. Amala Dr. Prabhu?
Yes, I was just going to add to what you were saying, is that sometimes persons who may have had what we call some degree of faith, when difficulties or great tribulations or great fearsome objects or situations confront them, they sometimes lose faith too. I know somebody, she was very frightened that her husband would die, and she had some faith, and she was praying, and her husband died, and then she gave up her faith. She says, I don't believe in God anymore. Because their concept or their understanding is just focused upon themselves, that God is my order. God is like a waiter. You just give him your order, and if he doesn't take your order, then he doesn't exist.
It's all about me. It's not all about God. That's the problem.
Exactly. So there's that side too, but then of course there's the other side that was indicated. If a person has had some degree of faith, they've tried everything possible that in order to remove the difficult situation, and nothing has worked, then out of desperation they may say, "Well, if there is a God, then please help me." And some help comes, and then they gain some preliminary faith. So it can go either way, actually.
Yeah, I would think that it's largely dependent on the individual, his personality and his desires, and how can you really mandate or even understand all that sort of thing. Yeah, I mean, the point that I was making is that we shouldn't overestimate our own faith. Because I was hearing Srila Prabhupada say this morning that muktanam api siddhanam narayana parayana kotishu api mahamune. Even... to find a person who's really surrendered to Krishna, it's less than one in a million. And for the rest of us, it's just a question of we have not been given a test that's formidable enough. That's why we retain our faith. At least it's good to maintain that attitude, whether it's true or not. Did you have a question?
I was just kind of curious about how karma affects demons. Like, I mean, do they... Do they basically maintain their same demoniac situation for a long period of time? I mean, do they also take different bodies? Humans, animals, I mean, demigods, and then kind of shift back. I mean, because I've heard other accounts, like...
How does karma impact the demons? Well, karma impacts everyone equally. And I mentioned the word morphing because it adequately describes what our situation is in any body, whether devic or asuric. We're constantly just shifting, and the desires are changing, and the reactions are changing, and we have to deal with that in various ways, and it's just... It's in a constant state of flux. So, you know, there's infinite variety. We've discussed this in the past, that, you know, there are just, if you want the pious options alone, there's at least 33 million options available to you. Eight 8,400,000, species of life, but that's, as I understand it, those are broad categories. I mean, I don't think the species have really been very well defined, either in Neo-Dorian synthesis nor in the Bhagavatam. But it's pretty colorful picture. Very, very multifarious creation of the Lord in a very bewildering place, like that Venn entry that Krishna mentions in chapter 15. The best thing is just chapter 15 of Bhagavad Gita. The best thing is to just take out your sword of knowledge and detachment and cut your way out by chanting Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.